Okay, go ahead. Back in a second.
I'm going to be creating the accounts tonight, and so please expect an email from me. We would prefer people to use SSH keys. How many people have access to a Linux machine? Put it a different way, how many people don't have access to a machine running Linux? Anyone? Good, I don't have Windows instructions, because that's a pain. I'll be sending out an email after class. Please check your email sometime tonight. I'm going to request that everybody send me public SSH keys for the purpose of logging in. We're not actually going to be handing out passwords on the accounts. So please just check your inboxes, follow instructions on the Linux machine. And how many people are unfamiliar with SSH using public-private keys? Great, then maybe you all can just send me keys. And I don't have to send out instructions. I'll still send out instructions.
Okay. Generally speaking, I'm fine with having the windows open. When we get to the end of the semester, I may have to ask us not to because I have terrible allergies. And I apologize in advance, but if there's a loud lawnmower going outside, which has occasionally happened in the past, I prefer not to listen to it. Especially not on the recording. All right. So any operating system has a life cycle. Depending on the operating system vendor, the life cycle has either four or five phases. The first, and by the way, this is actually true for most software. The first phase is nothing works. And this is kind of boring, and it goes for a depressingly long time. The second phase is something works. And the question is, how much is something? The third phase is rolling crisis. This is the major phase for most software life cycles. This is the phase where things are still broken. But if you're really lucky, you actually get the patches out before the customers notice. I like to think of this as keeping up with the Joneses. So this is the phase where the user is sitting in front of the computer and something goes wrong and it's really aggravating and they look at the display and they say something like, "Oh man, you're Jonesing me," right? And you want to have the answer, "Look, it's already fixed, just go get the later version," right? That's the keeping up with the Joneses part. And then the fourth phase in most software is retirement. They never actually go through the fifth phase, which is things actually work. This is hard. Make sure this thing is running. Yeah, my God, it's running. Okay. So, and the reason is that we have very poor tools for understanding whether software actually works. We have challenges of specification, and then assuming you had a specification, we have challenges of analysis. It's not that we don't know how to answer the question, does the system work? For the most part, we don't even know how to rigorously express the question, what would it mean for the system to work? And certainly not in an automated expression, which is what we'd sort of like if we want to do automated testing. One of the problems that arises in security assurance, right? You go to the National Security Agency or whatever country you're in, there's some equivalent agency that does high assurance evaluation, right? And it works like this. You walk up with like $7 or $8 million and they explain to you why you're not going to get the rating you want. You do this several times and hopefully the process converges. There are actually three examples in the last 35 years of that process converging. Maybe there are now four. The problem is not that the first convergence costs $7 million to do. That's one of those things that makes business people wrinkle their noses, and complain about the temperature of the water, but there may be good business justification for doing that. The problem is that the next week, when you apply a bug fix to the code base, you're basically in the position of starting over from scratch because you've got no credible way to demonstrate that the promises you made last week that were carefully validated are still in fact valid this week after the bug fix is applied. And the observation is specifications move slowly. At least high-level requirements move slowly. Software has a way of moving very quickly, and if you can't automate the check of conformance, you're just not in an engineerable position. And this, coupled with the relatively small market for assurance at those levels, is part of why we have not developed a science for software robustness. Now, another part of it is that that's deeply hard to do. But, you know, as with any deeply hard problem, it doesn't get any closer to solution unless you actually get some people to pay attention to it, and we've managed to disincentivize that. Okay, enough of that. AOS is now in the keeping up with the Joneses stage. In fact, we are going up tomorrow. In fact, we're driving up tonight, but starting tomorrow, we've got a 3-day series of meetings with the customer, and it's the first time they're going to try to use this system. And I promise you, it's going to break at least 8 times during those 3 days. If it only breaks 8 times, I'll be delighted. There are not so much missing pieces as gaping holes in what we're delivering. There's function that obviously needs to be there. It needs to be part of the system. It just isn't built yet. On the other hand, they need to get things built. We're sort of in the position where they need to start working, and we're going to try this mode of keeping just ahead of them. And some days I think we'll succeed, and some days we will probably fail. Okay. Last time I talked about what the Kyotos object model looks like as opposed to what the hardware object model looks like. And I waved my hands and I declared that you could establish a correspondence between these things and you could maintain it. We're not quite at the point where I can walk you through how we do that. I think that'll end up being next week. What I want to do for the first half today is I actually want to go back to code. And I also, the syllabus is now up. The MP3s for past lectures are now up. These will be up before I skip town after class. I do urge you, check the syllabus before you come to class. You know, the once a week thing, we're sort of in a problem and it's hard to give notice. I can then send things out on the email list. Just double check what we're going to look at that day and make sure you've got an up-to-date version. So for example, today I'm going to go through a bunch of stuff in init.c, which has changed significantly since the one that I handed out, partly because of some of those keeping up with the Joneses kinds of issues. And it's not even that the changes are overwhelming or hard to explain. This is more at the level of, wait, I did the problems from the wrong version of the textbook. Right? It's not that you didn't do them. It's that you now have this irritating problem to resolve. Okay, so we're out of boot.s, and I promised I wouldn't do quite that level of laboriousness again. What do you imagine is the first thing you'd like to have when your kernel starts running? From the perspective now of a developer. Debugger, that's a plausible choice. In fact, nowadays, at least if you're developing for a PC, there are at least two, and in fact, there's a third, although they don't advertise it, their emulator, that has a GDB mechanism. And at least one of those has the property that it simulates hardware breakpoints correctly, which turns out to be important. So in fact, we're not hugely excited about running a kernel debugger. One of the major differences between Kyotos and Eros is that a third of the code in Eros was a debugger that knew everything you could possibly want to know about everything that was going on, and we dropped that. And we're now in the awkward position of wishing like hell that somebody had built a serious scripting language into GDB, which has been an outstanding project for at least 8 years. People keep talking about it, but nobody does anything about it. So, plausible, probably second choice. What's the first thing you want?
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
So,
no!
Yeah.
Yes, of course you can ask a question.
I want to take a step back and ask, in a sense, why does it matter which is first?
Why does it matter what's first?
The first thing that a developer would want, can't do anything until you get to the
next. So what's the first thing you want to do, though, is what I'm asking. What's the very first thing you want to do? So the thing about this course is we're actually trying to come bottom up, which is a little confusing because people internalize sort of frameworks and systems and knowledge much better top down, which is why I'm going back and forth in each class doing some bottom up time and some top down time. And we do have a convergence problem in the early few weeks, and it's real. So I should acknowledge it. But okay, what do you want to know? I mean, you've run a fair bit of code. You've tried to set up a system. Right? Nice to have what? Nice to have memory to execute in. You're close. Even before that, what do I want to know? Much memory there is. I would like to know that, but that's actually not important yet. It's a reasonable thing to do first. I mean, several of these are reasonable things you might do first. Ah, you're all engaged in an assumption. The assumption is that you're actually running the operating system. We don't actually know that yet, right? What we know is that we've seen the advertising, right? And that we've seen grub come and go. We do not know that we're doing anything productive yet. So one of the first things you'd like to see is, here I am. You know, I've made it to someplace. I don't mean me know where, but at least someplace. You know, I have seen the operating system, and this is it, to paraphrase. So depending on your platform, and it might be that using a debugger would be a fine way to do this. The problem with debuggers in this context is that they are, they have a way of slipping away from you, and operating systems are highly concurrent. And these two things interacting together make debuggers very hard to use. And I'll give an example of that in a second. So if you have the luxury of a display, and for embedded OS developers, that's the luxury. First thing you want is the subsystem that prints stuff to your display. Right? If you actually power your cell phone all the way down and power it back up, you'll probably discover that pretty much the first thing it does is clear your display either to white or some predefined background image, right? And the second thing it does is give you the version number of something. That version number is telling you two things. I mean, it's telling you obviously what version you're loading, sometimes, assuming they got the right number in there. It's telling you that you're loading something. And with the help of a bare system board, getting to the point where you're loading something is not so minor a victory. So the first thing you want to bring up is the console subsystem, if you have one. Failing that, you want to run some kind of a blinking light somewhere. You know, Morse code may be good, depending on how deeply embedded your embedded system is.
I thought for kernels the console subsystem was the debug.
How do you say that?
I mean, you had been talking about like the binary search technique for debugging.
Oh, okay. Yes.
Obviously not the only debugger, but...
You know what? I did lead you down that garden path. Okay, let me tell a very brief anecdote. The client that we're going up to visit tomorrow is interested in developing on a processor called the ColdFire on a fairly deeply embedded set of boards. They're doing a family of products. In spite of this, we chose to bring up our kernel on the Pentium family first. But of course, that involves some delay in what they want. So why did we choose to do that? We did it for two reasons. The first is we know the processor cold, and you'd sort of like to fight hardware issues in a separate phase than fighting software issues. And for better or worse, we know this machine. But the other reason is that deeply embedded board doesn't have a display that's straightforward to set up. And being able to get those printfs early was something we wanted. Now, strictly speaking, we could accomplish that with the debugger. In fact, if you were to dig into the right place in the source tree, you would discover that there's a script that can be loaded into GDB. And that script defines a new GDB command, which I think is called print message buffer or print buffer or something like that. And that command will actually, the way the console system works, it doesn't just spew text to the display. What it does is it first puts the text into a ring buffer, and then at the same time, it puts it on the display. This means if you don't have the display, you still have the ring buffer. And what the print message buffer function does in GDB is it knows by incestuous knowledge where the ring buffer is, and it dumps the content to the ring buffer so you can see what's there. Does anybody here not know what a ring buffer is? Okay. So the idea is it's a block of memory that you're just going to write in circular fashion. And hopefully you're not going to run out before you get in trouble, because you would like this ring buffer to be big enough that later you're going to run application code, and the first thing the application code is going to do is dump the ring buffer so that it can preserve the entire trail. But, you know, if things go really wrong, you may see lots of stuff going to the ring buffer. So, indeed, you could even imagine going a step further. You could imagine implementing the following hack to achieve the same result with GDB. Right? So, if you dig down into the console system, you'll discover that it, at least in principle, is supposed to operate in two phases. I think it currently doesn't. First is it should put the text in the ring buffer, and the second is it should go back and print the text that it just put in the ring buffer. Why? Because then you could take the procedure that does the go back and print, and you could stub it out to do nothing. And why would you want to do that? Because then you can put a breakpoint on it, and then you can tell the debugger, whenever you stop at that breakpoint, this is now an empty procedure. It exists for the sole purpose of being able to put a breakpoint on it. Whenever you stop at that procedure, dump the latest bit in the ring buffer to the GDB display, and then just continue. And now you have another console. So you could get away without a display, but you can sort of see that this involves a layering of trickery that is not immediately obvious. And certainly if you have people who are contributing to your project, it's a layer of trickery that they're not going to get the first or maybe the second time through. So, whatever. We like to bring up the console first so we can say goodbye world before we get to see the BIOS advertising again. Okay. Next thing you need to do, something to say about the console, right? You don't know where memory is yet. You can assume, since you have been loaded, that the memory and data that was part of your binary image is present. Because otherwise, hopefully, you wouldn't have gotten loaded. The loader would have complained. So any console logic you're going to build needs to operate out, if you're going to start it this early, it needs to operate out of resource that was compiled into your binary. Right? So that ring buffer is actually declared as a statically allocated array. Mainly because one of the places that we want to be able to issue printf statements is inside the piece of code that analyzes the physical memory regions. Why? Because it turns out most BIOSes report them wrong. And you'd like to be able to see which way they got them wrong. In a nice bug of that form a few days ago. Okay. So, bring that up so it can talk to us. We can't yet talk to it except through the debugger. The next thing that we're doing in this kernel, and this probably only applies to multiprocessor and only for a peculiar reason, is we're going through and we're initializing the CPU structures. I mean in the sense of running their constructors. And it turns out that this structure is something that ordinarily it could just be zero filled and we'd be okay. But there's one field in the structure that can't be zero filled, and this has to do with how locking works. So let me divert here and I will talk about spin locks for a minute. Maybe for more than a minute. Well, I'm going to talk about locks, not just spin locks. So there are just lots of ways for multiprocessors to get themselves in trouble. And just about the time you think you've understood them all, there will be another one. And all of them turn out to have the same manifestation. I was reading there. No, I was writing there. No, I was writing there. No, you were reading there. Or some variant of this. And people talk about lots of fancy strategies for avoiding this problem, but all of them down at the bottom are built on one of two mechanisms in the real world. And then there's the Dijkstra algorithm, which nobody actually uses because it's impossibly slow. Either you use a class of data structure called a weight-free data structure. The idea of a weight-free data structure is you carefully design the data structure so that you and the routines that manipulate the data structure, so that you and I can do concurrent accesses to the data structure, and neither of us will get into trouble. Let me give you an example of a data structure that has a fairly obvious weight-free implementation. A linked list, you may have heard of one of these. And here's the idea. I want to insert a new element into the front of the list. You want to be able to read the list. We don't want to get into trouble doing this. And there's a race with who wins updating the pointer at the head of the list. Actually, there's also an analogous removal problem. So here's what you do. Most processors implement an operation that's often called CAS, which stands for compare and swap. The Intel folks, just to be different, called theirs compare and exchange. It's the same operation. Here's what the operation does. Okay, I did the great Karnak last week, right? So this is the great Karnak again, right? I'm thinking of a pointer, right? This is the answer, and then what's the question, right? The question is, what pointer value is actually in memory? So here's how you do this protocol. I'm gonna deal with the insert. So we're interested here in the head pointer. Oh, that was a terrible way to draw that. We're interested here in the word of memory that contains the pointer to the first element in the list. That's how the protocol goes. First thing I'm gonna do is I'm gonna read the pointer. And in fact, I'm gonna atomically read the pointer, meaning that I'm not gonna get a mixture of bits if you happen to be in the process of writing that pointer. And it turns out that on most hardware architectures, there are still some exceptions, but on most hardware architectures nowadays, any word-sized read is guaranteed to be atomic. And the reason is that the cache hardware guarantees consistency, and in order to do that, it guarantees that you have a local copy, and your read is actually occurring against the local copy. All right, so I'm going to read the pointer. And now I'm going to do a compare and swap. What's compare and swap? Compare and swap implements the following operation. If, the atomic read is going to give me the current value at that location. Compare and swap says, if the value that is presently out there matches the one I think it is, the one that I expect, then, and only then, overwrite that value with this here new value. Otherwise, tell me what value is out there. This comparison and the conditional exchange, the conditional write, is done as a single atomic operation. And the reason it's usually called compare and swap is that I've left out a detail, which is that actually both legs tell me what the old value was at that memory location. So I'm saying, look, let me grab the value, now let me check if it's still there. And if it's still there, I'm going to overwrite. And the way I'm going to know that it succeeded is that the value that comes back is the same as the old value that I expected. Now, where would I use this? Here's my new element that I want to stick into the list. At the moment that I go to stick it into the list, I'm the only party who holds this element, so I don't have to worry about any concurrency issues. So the first thing I do is I take the old head pointer and I arrange for my element to point to the old right. Now what I got to do is I got to update the head pointer. I'm going to use the compare and swap to do that. The catch is you may be trying to do the same thing. I have to try several times to go through this loop because I could get lucky. In fact, I'm probably going to get lucky. Everything will be good. Or I could go and discover, hey, somebody else got there first. Now the head pointer has changed, so I got to go back and update my copy. And eventually this will converge and I will insert. That's the assertion. There's a problem with this class of algorithm, which is that it's very hard to ensure that the opportunity to update is fairly distributed among processors. And there is a, you know, if you go through an OS textbook, it will tell you that fairness is important in concurrency. This is one of these things that's true on paper more than it is in reality. There are certainly cases where fairness is a thing of great importance. All of those cases are cases where you're seeing very high concurrency on the lock. If, as a matter of practice, if I go out there and 999 times out of 1,000, nobody else is diddling the lock, if I'm the only person trying to modify it, it doesn't really matter how fair the world is, because I'm always going to succeed. If one time out of 1,000 I'm not interfering with somebody else, then I got to start to worry about fairness. Observation. If you get to the point where one time out of 1,000 nobody else is diddling with the lock, and 999 times out of 1,000 you collide, you have a much bigger problem to solve than figuring out how to make this lock be fair. What you have is an architecture problem, which is to figure out how to get this lock to go away in favor of an architecture which does not demand management of that very high concurrency. Because there is no winning strategy when the concurrency is that high. Somewhere in the middle, there's a threshold decision. Where that threshold decision is, you know, it has to do with a lot of factors that can't be easily synopsized. I would personally say, look, if you get to the point where fairness is a question, you do need to at least look at the locking architecture of the system. Now, this compare and swap thing can be used in the other direction as well. Suppose I want to take this element in the middle out. What I have to do is I have to go back to the guy ahead of him and say, oh, well, I think the next element is this element I'm trying to take out. And what I do is a compare and swap, copying his next pointer to the guy in front of him. Here again, the list may get updated as I go. Actually, in this case, that's unlikely. Now, why the atomic read? Well, I could be doing that update while you are traversing the list. Notice that because the read is atomic and because my update is atomic, You will either get the old value or the new value. I can't tell you which, but I know you will get one of them. And then what I need is a mechanism that allows me to know that object that I just took out of the list, nobody could hold a pointer to it. Because then I can reclaim it. So the problem is pushed from concurrency. Now, two requirements here. One, this only works if you're talking about algorithms where having the very latest information about the list is not required. If I'm going to read this list and it matters that I have exactly current information, this whole strategy doesn't work. At that point, I need to lock. And the dual of that is I'm trying to take something out and free it to have a means to know that everybody's done with it. And there are strategies for doing that. So weight-free data structures are one approach to this. There's an entire operating system that was built exclusively using weight-free data structures as a research experiment by Mike Greenwald and colleagues. Very interesting and very high performance result. Not something that I would want to ask your average bear or even your average senior computer scientist to try to reproduce. Weight-free data structures are a beautiful idea. I think they're most complicated to use, and they're not, because of their complexity, I would not characterize them as a general purpose operating system design tool. Because making sure that all of your data structures have this property is a fairly severe architectural constraint. It qualitatively changes the way you have to design the system. Okay. Option two is you can say, well, look, I'm going to manipulate the list. And while I'm manipulating the list, you're not going to manipulate the list. And the way we're going to do that is that associated with the list, or associated with something we're going to get to before the list, we're going to have something called a lock word. And there are lots of ways you can use lock words, and people will talk about mutexes versus semaphores versus peanut butter sandwiches versus lions and tigers and bears. On real hardware at the bottom, they all come down to the lock word, because that's the hardware mechanism that you build all this stuff on, namely this compare and swap thing if you've got it. The lock word basically goes like this, and I'm making up a convention. It is not the only convention you could use. You need to have a convention. It happens to be the one that we use in the Coyotes code. If the word is zero, nobody holds the lock. Good. This means you can get the lock. If the word is non-zero, then this generally means the lock is held. And there are several things that we would like to record. We would like to know, we actually have something called the type field, because we had multiple disciplines of locking for a while. We've now gotten down to one. But that type field still exists. You need at least some field that says held, not held. So you're going to have a type field, but it may only be one bit. What else do you want to know? Well, you would like to know the CPU ID. This is just a number. Each CPU has one. Hopefully no two agree on their number, which holds the lock. Why? Because if you're Tarzan and you're more important than that CPU, you want to know who to go whack over the head. You also might like to be able to know you hold the lock already. There are cases of cyclical locking in real systems, and they are a hazard in most systems. And that's something I'm going to talk about in a few minutes. And then we have another field, which I'm going to call the generation number. And that's the thing I'm about to have to explain, because this is not conventional. In most systems, lock is either held or not held. Something like a generation number might be replaced by a counter if you have a system design that allows cyclical locking. Cyclical locking is, I grab a lock because I have to do something protected by that lock, but maybe I have to call some other procedure. Maybe that other procedure gets called from other places, and those other places don't always grab the necessary locks. Sometimes you get into these sort of chicken and egg problems, and boy, it's really convenient if you say, well, I'll just have the nested procedure grab the lock again. Okay? And this is okay, because it turns out checking do I already hold the lock is not so expensive. And as long as you keep track of your counts and for every lock you do a release, this will be okay. You have to observe a stack discipline. That's where this starts to get a little hairy. What's not good is when you do this with two different locks. Okay? As long as the nested party is always grabbing a lock you already hold, you're okay. The problem is if you get into a situation where you need A and B in that order and the other guy needs B and A in that order. This is an invitation to something called deadlock, and we talked about Iowa last week or the week before. Deadlock is not good. It's a non-recoverable condition. Well, it's a, let me say that differently. It's a condition requiring some delicacy of recovery. It is, in fact, recoverable, but you better detect it. And I'm going to talk in a second about how we do that. Anyway, the reason we're initializing the silly CPU structures first is because we have to assign them CPU IDs. Now, this is very complicated. There's a vector of 0 to n CPUs, and their CPU IDs are, surprise, 0 to n. Unfortunately, they're not just 0, so we actually have to get them initialized. We could do it statically, but it's, you know, it's easier to just go through and assign the numbers. I don't want to do this, because until we do this, we can't take any locks. Why can't we take any locks? Because we'd be writing zeros. I just told a lie. No, I didn't. It's not that we have to initialize the CPU IDs. It's that we have to tell each CPU what its value is for the lock word, which is actually the type plus CPU UID part. You had a question back there?
I was wondering why you were using explicit read of memory instead
of... I can't hear you.
Why are you using both the CPU ID instead of just a relative value into the array, right? An index, presumably.
I'll get to that. So, if all we cared about was a zero or a non-zero value, yeah, we could just use the pointer to the element in the array, and that would serve as our lock word value, and that would work fine. Two reasons we don't do it. One I'm going to come to. The other is we're desperately trying to avoid idioms that rely on pointer tricks. We're trying to restrict ourselves to as safe a subset of C as we can do in anticipation of getting out of C in the future into some other language that we can formally analyze. So there's a class of tricks that we've chosen to avoid. That would work. And in other systems, that would be a fine solution. And notice at this point, we don't have any other CPUs. It's just that we need to know what the lock word should be for CPU 0. There's another question out there. Okay. One of the things I said, I think it was in the first week, is that EOTOS is a transactional system. I think I said that, and then I went on to say, well, no, a better way to think about it is Kyoto Systems calls make a really good effort at attempting to be atomic. There are places where they cheat. For the most part, they're atomic. And when I say cheat, I mean the rule is either no important modification has happened, or we may have allowed some modification to happen for performance reasons, but we've explicitly stated that whatever bits got modified are considered undefined until the operation can complete successfully. That's the cheating part. How does this matter? Suppose I'm running through the kernel, and I need to access a resource, process, a page, something. I can't get it. Why can't I get it? I can't get it because you're doing something with it at the moment. That's what the lock is for. To make sure that we get some serialization of work, at least with respect to one object at a time. Well, that would be fine if I only needed one resource. And it would still be fine if I could somehow induce a total ordering or even a sufficiently good partial ordering on the order in which I was going to need resources. So for example, if I could say, I will always grab locks on GPTs first, and then I will grab locks on pages. This would be all right. How do I need that partial order? Well, I'm trying to avoid the AB problem where CPU 0 comes in and grabs A successfully, and now goes to grab B and can't, because CPU 1 has already gotten that, right? And CPU 1 now goes to grab A and can't because CPU 0 has already gotten that. Both must stop and neither can continue until the other has passed out of sight. It's really easy to draw the picture when you have only two elements. The general requirement is that you have some cycle, and that cycle can involve an arbitrarily large number of elements, and this means that detecting this condition is actually tricky. There are cases you can run into that look like this. I try to grab a lock that's already held. I can't get it, but I'm not in trouble yet because I haven't got a cycle. The requirement is I have to have a hold and wait condition, and I also have to have a cycle. If either of those requirements is not present, I don't have a problem yet. I just have a delay. That may be a problem for other reasons, but it's not a problem for locking reasons. Okay. Why is this such a mess? I mean, you might say, look, we'll detect it and somebody will back out. Well, what does it mean to back out? Obviously, if I'm going to back out, I'm going to give up my locks. That's the whole point of backing out. Except, in a non-atomic system, I may have a substantial investment in work that I've already done. The cost of backing out is that I have to reconcile the fact that some of this work that I've already architecturally reconciled in the specification, the fact that some of this work that I've already done may have two properties. One, it may be visible at application level that I've done it, and two, I may not be able to redo it later. An example, if I'm asked to read 200 characters from a terminal and I get 10 of them and then I block for some reason, there's no way I can go back to the terminal later and say, by the way, please give me those 10 characters again, I lost them. And this is why the Unix read system call tells you how many bytes it got as opposed to how many bytes you asked for. And the introduction of interruptible system calls was a big issue in the history of Unix. It was a mess. For a while, it was one of the big divides between the Berkeley system and the AT&T system. I'm sorry, not interruptible system calls. That was in early. System calls that could recover from being interrupted, that was a Berkeley innovation. Sort of. Now, what do you do in these situations? Well, you know, one answer, and it's the answer in a lot of systems, is you hope like hell it doesn't happen, and when it happens, you return a partial result and you declare victory. Or, if you can't sensibly return a partial result, shoot somebody. Pick one of those processes involved in the mess and just pull the plug on it. Because it doesn't happen often enough that anybody's going to care. It'd be bad if that was BD flush. Okay. That's been observed once in the wild over 20 years and millions of systems. Maybe it's okay. Another approach is to say, well, no, we'd like a little more design discipline than that. And let me be clear, I put that in a value-laden way, and let me be clear that I mean it in a value-laden way, but let me also be fair about it. The Linux Unix position, VMS position, other systems are saying, look, some events are so unlikely that the right thing to do when they happen is to eat the bullet. It's not an irrational position. It allows you to engage in designs that work the overwhelming majority of the time, and that are often faster than a more disciplined design. It will not comfort you when your airplane falls out of the sky. So that's not an appropriate design outcome if you're doing a flight control system. So, and often when I engage in value judgments, I'm interested in the level of reliability that we require in things like flight control systems. So that's where I'm coming from, and that is, in a fashion, an indictment of Linux, but one has to take it for what it is. It's not a grand indictment of Linux. Well, the other option would be to say, look, we're going to craft the specification carefully, and we're going to craft the implementation carefully to have the property that we can always back out and never get caught. Or by never get caught, I mean there's nothing we have to undo, or we're always able to report a partial result, or maybe updates that we have done that we can't back out, but they are replayable, and since the specification said that those updates are indeterminate until the operation completes, that's okay. There are, in systems like Unix, there are other cases where I may actually hold a long-term lock that I just can't let go of. So in Unix, it's very common for processes to take a bunch of locks and reach a point where they have to wait for something. They call a procedure called sleep. And that sleep could be microseconds or it could be days. Sleeping for days with locks held is double plus ungood. Because the longer your lock is held, the longer the window of opportunity comes for all of us to move to Iowa. Nothing personal against Iowa. I just love the law. Locks should be held for a short time, right? Get in, do what you got to do, get out. Short is a relative term. The problem with sleep, right, is that, I may have to hold a lock on a file, for example, if I'm going through the Unix file system, and now I'm doing a read, and I get to the bottom, and I need a disk lock, and oops, it's not in the buffer cache, which means I have to go out to the disk drive. And now I'm going to hold the lock for a long time. Disk drives are almost, as peripherals go, disk drives are almost as slow as you are. Or, from the computer perspective, a very slow peripheral. 12 milliseconds or something like this is a very long time to hold the lock when you've got a clock on the processor going in units of gigahertz. There's just a mismatch here. What's the answer? Well, in many implementations of Unix, what happens is you hold the locks, and most of those locks are on fungible resources. You may hold a lock on a free page. I may need a free page. It doesn't really matter if I get your free page. The system will give me some other free page. But most of the time, you get away with it. When you don't get away with it, the Unix kernel picks a loser, whacks all your locks, and terminates your system call in progress, and usually you along with it. Why? Well, because you were in the middle of something. We don't know where you are. This operation really is not recoverable. Okay, EDIS doesn't do this. EDIS simply never permits that situation to arise at all in the kernel. And this has an interesting implication, which is why I told this whole long exegesis about locking. And anybody who's worked on concurrent systems will tell you, like, locking is the world's worst nightmare. If I'm going to hold these locks for a long time, it's very important that I release them. And in Unix systems, and in many monolithic systems, you can get into sequences, right? First, I do one thing, okay, I get that done. Now I go into another thing, okay, I get that done. Now I go into a third thing. And there are going to be several stages at which I can sleep. And if I grabbed locks early that I no longer need, I would like to release them as soon as I reasonably can. Certainly, if what I'm grabbing is something involving high concurrency. So the consequence is you see a stack discipline in the handling of locks. And the rule is, whatever order you grab them in, release them in the opposite order. There are minor refinements on this rule. This is always, but this is basically the rule. I mean, if I'm releasing A and B at the same time, it may not matter what order I actually release them in as long as I release them both, but if anything else comes in the middle, there's a problem. Why do I want to do this? Well, because B might be something that you need. I may want to go on to something else. I don't want to block you while I'm going on to something else, because if I block you, that really raises the likelihood that we're going to get hurt. This is how lock errors happen. Because what happens now is you'll discover some condition that'll arise in the code, and you'll see the following code pattern. A, if some condition, like if there's some error prevailing that's going to stop me from making further progress, but I had to do something to find out about this error, and release A and return. Otherwise, proceed a lot longer doing something useful, get to the end, release A, and return. Do not return without releasing A. A will never get released if you do this. And this is a wonderful property if you want to write academic papers, because you get to do yet another analysis system that works for some cases, and run the analysis system on the Linux kernel, and you can find 50 locking errors. Bingo, you got a publication. It's low-hanging fruit. Really low-hanging fruit. Because these errors are forever, because the kernel can't undo your locks, right? Really, there's no good way to do that. But we use a different technique. And this is why I'm going through all this. Let me be careful. The kernel can release your locks if it notices that you've exited the kernel, because presumably then you're done with them. So we could imagine a variance design in which these source code errors that are static errors in the source code could be mitigated. And I'm working my way up to showing you a locking technique that would do that. And it would be tempting to do that because, you know, most of the time you're not going to get caught in these things, and it would allow the kernel to survive a higher degree of bad code. Masking the effect of bad code is a two-edged sword. What you take is a problem that's very hard to reproduce, and you make it much, much, much harder to reproduce. And this is good in the sense that the customer won't feel it as often, but it's bad in the sense that you've got no chance at all of fixing it when you do that. And let's be clear, this was a bug, and what we did was sweep it under the rug if we do automated release. Suppose the rule were, I will never permit a process to sleep in the kernel. I'm not going to allow them. Okay, there's an edge condition, right? I may not have to bounce it all the way out to user land, right? What usually happens when a process enters the kernel, and enters the kernel, it does this very first step that saves its registers, right? And then it decides what it's going to do. I could push it back to the point just after it saves its registers, but before it's decided what it's going to do. Why would I want to do that? Because it turns out getting into the kernel is expensive. But that process still logically has been pushed out of the kernel. It holds no kernel resources. The rule is we are never going to allow a process to sleep with any resource held. Now, this rule is only possible if we've started from the position of saying that we're going to do an atomic system design, or that we're going to subdivide every operation into a series of atomic operations internally, so that we have well-defined sequence points where we can basically push the process back out of the kernel with no resources held. If we can do that, and we did, a very interesting thing happens to locking. You never have to release a lock. Right? I got the emphasis wrong. You never have to release a lock. Big points where you want to release a lock, but that's for reasons of performance, not for reasons of correctness. Why? Well, if we bounce you out of the kernel and we know that having bounced you out of the kernel, you hold no resource, then we know that you're done with all of your locks, don't we? Just basically holding a lock, that's kind of what we mean when we say holding a resource. This brings me to the generation idea, which I mislabeled. Sorry about that. So I got the proportions wrong. It's the transaction idea. Now, what the hell is this transaction idea? Every time a process enters this kernel, every time a CPU makes a I got to do another part before I explain the transaction ID. If a process can sleep in the kernel while holding resources, one of the resources that I promise you it holds is a stack. After all, it's 20 calls deep into the kernel logic, it's just grabbed the lock, and then it's discovered it needs to wait for a disk block. The reason we're going to sleep in the kernel is we don't want to back out and do those 20 calls again. They may represent a lot of work. So if we sleep, we're going to hang on to our stack. And a consequence of this is that every Unix process requires a kernel stack of its own. When you fork a Unix process, one of the things you are allocating is some kernel storage that's going to hold the stack of that process while it is in the kernel. Conversely, if we declare no process sleeps with a held resource, then there need be no per process kernel stack. There needs to be a per CPU kernel stack, but when your process lets go with a CPU, I can reuse that stack for the next process because your process doesn't need a stack. So I started off on this transaction ID, and I was about to say the transaction ID is a per CPU counter. Every time a CPU enters the kernel, that is to say, every time a process executes an instruction that causes it to enter the kernel, so in consequence, the CPU is entering the kernel on its behalf, this counter gets bumped. So if you were to look at the CPU structure, you would find a transID field, I think it's called transID, something like this, and it starts at zero and it goes up, and if it rolls over, oh well. I'll explain the oh well in a second. But we increment it. Now, I said, if the lock word is zero, it is not held. That's not how it works in the Kyoto system. The rule in the Kyoto system is the lock is held, the type field is non-zero, and if you were to go to the CPU ID and ask, what is your current transaction ID? Check, did that match the transaction ID stored in the lock word? If those match, then the lock is held. Let me do that again. So I said there's a transID field in the CPU. That's not true. What's in the CPU is a field called something like lock value. Okay? And this field is a field that takes the form transaction ID, comma, 1, because it turns out there's only one type now in the code, comma, CPU ID. And the transaction ID part gets incremented every time we enter the kernel. And if we want to know if this lock is held, we go back to the CPU and we just compare the two words. If they're equal, it's held. If they're not equal, then what has happened is this lock is no longer current, but the guy who grabbed it did not have the grace to release it. How could that come about? Boy, you know, I've grabbed 40 or 50 locks and various bits of stuff, and I've just realized I'm not going to make any further progress in whatever it was I was doing. Now, my job now is to get out, because somebody else might make progress. And the last thing I want to do is run a whole lot of code on my stack for the sole purpose of releasing these godforsaken locks, most of which nobody's going to look at. There's always going to be one. But if I grab 50 locks, the reality is only one of them is going to get hit by the next party into the kernel. So putting the cost on me to release 50 for the sake of helping one, this just seems like the wrong way to place the burden. It's a necessary way to place the burden, if I can sleep in the kernel with a held stack. If I'm going to bail on all my resources, there's a simpler way to do it. I can do a gang release. How do I do a gang release? Pump the transaction ID in the CPU field. Whatever it was, it doesn't have the same value now. And now you'll go to the lock word and say, oh, looks like you grabbed lock. No, you cheated. But I'll take it. And if you go look at the implementation of mutex in kern mutex, you'll see how this is done. It uses the compare and swap primitive. First time you go in, you say, well, you know, I hope it's zero. If it's zero, I'm good to go, and I'll just grab it. If it's not zero, guess what I get back? I get back the current value. Now I go to your CPU, and I say, does this match you? Now, if it doesn't match you, it's never going to match you again. But once you're done with the transaction ID, you're done with it forever. Forever here, you should hear in quotation marks. It's going to be a long time before you regenerate that number. Like something on the order of 2 to 20 kernel entries. More than enough for us to figure out whether you own the lock word. But now to say, oh, good, I know now what the stale word value is. As long as that stale word value, when I go back the second time, still is the same stale word value that it was before, now I'll grab the lock, right? But I've checked that it's been released. Yeah.
Is the fact that that transaction ID does eventually loop a problem when you're like your security story about how...
I've said a couple of times, I'm going to come back to that.
Okay.
And when I do, I will ask you to repeat your question because I didn't have the courtesy to let you finish it. I apologize. Okay, here's the point though. The pattern in the Kyotos kernel is gang release. There are a few locks that are grabbed and released immediately, but as a rule, we don't even bother to release them. Releasing them takes time. The argument for releasing them was you wanted a short hold time. Microkernels have short hold times by definition because the end-to-end path through the kernel is measured in units of microseconds. Why do the extra work? Exceptions. There are some objects that we know are dynamically high concurrency, and those we release as a matter of courtesy. What's the hazard of the transaction ID trick? Let me deal first with the concurrency hazard, not security. Okay. So I said it'll be a long time before this ID rolls over. It will. However, it will roll over. And when it rolls over, what will happen is we will see objects that appear to be locked for a moment, only appear to be locked because they have the misfortune that the lock word happens to match a current value. Why? Because this is a 32-bit quantity, and 32 bits just isn't that big after you steal 16 bits for other purposes. It's still 7 bits, so it's bigger than that. But and this is a low likelihood occurrence. Notice that if it happens, it's a performance issue, not a correctness issue. The worst that will happen is you will fail to acquire a lock that you think you want. You will back out. I will proceed, my transaction ID will increment, and then the object you thought you needed will now be available to you. So it's a transient performance issue. However, we don't care for these things. It turns out we have a background task that has to go through for other reasons, periodically looking at all the objects. That background task checks lock words to see if they are current, and it zeros them if they are not. Earlier I said hiding mistakes is bad policy. This may be an example of that. There's a qualitative difference between something that's flatly wrong and something that is a transient recoverable error and you're trying to assist the speed of recovery. However, that's a weak statement from a qualitative design perspective. That's particularly the kind of design statement that you should always put a check mark by in your head and say, you know, that sounds kind of suspicious. I want to think about that. He's saying there's one case that should be handled one way and another case should be handled another way, and they sure kind of look pretty similar qualitatively. We wanted to raise a security question.
I think you actually may have essentially solved it by introducing your runs around and clean stuff.
It's a hack.
Yeah, as long as you can guarantee that it runs, it will have been run at least once before you get through enough to the point where you...
We can't guarantee that. We can guarantee that with high likelihood it will do so. Here's the argument for why we're not worried about it. When you actually look at this word, the type and the CPU ID are currently about 7 bits. That allows us to support up to 64 CPUs. If you have more than that, you need to be running a different kernel anyway. A 7 out of 32 leaves. Oh, come on. You thought I wasn't going to do this anymore, right? 25. Good. I'm really depressed that more of you didn't know that. 25. 2 to the 25 is a staggeringly big number. It's 32 million events. Now, let me just give you an intuition for why I think we're not going to get caught. The visitor, right, the thing that's going through and doing the cleaning, has to visit every object once before your number rolls over. So the proposal is that what we should do is one of two things, if we're really worried about it. One, we could argue, if I can't get all the objects visited, in the time it takes you to do 16 million kernel entries, we have bigger problems of scale than this to worry about. At that point, by the way, we're probably running on a 64-bit processor, so I'm not really restricted to 16 million entries. I could probably increase that by another 232. But there's another argument. The other argument goes, look, aha, I know something about locking. Suppose I could guarantee that every CPU will contribute a little bit to cleaning up the problem. So I'm going to put a tax on every processor. This is if I need hard real-time solution that's guaranteed. Tax goes like this. Every time you exit the kernel, you get to clean the next four objects. Now all I have to do is some multiplication. If 16 million entries times four objects is less than the total number of objects in memory, I'm done. This is now an incremental collection or an incremental reclamation strategy, very similar in spirit to the way incremental garbage collectors work. But one of the things you'll find about operating system designers, they have a never-ending supply of dirty tricks like this for transferring costs around. You can never make costs go away. Right? You can push them into one corner or a different corner. You can distribute them across your victims in different ways. But you either have to do the work or you don't. What you do get to change is, in this case, a robustness argument. Right? Maybe I would have done 16 million calls once in a blue moon. Who cares? Fine. Change a robustness argument. You can also change a variance argument. The real reason to want to do that, you know, for cleanups and entry tax, is that the overhead is very smooth. There's never going to be a point where anybody is going to stop and say, oh, crud, now I got to do 16 million cleanups. Anybody who's used Smalltalk has experienced that personally, or Java. Although recent versions of Java do a little better, but they do that at the cost of lowering the actual rate of progress. Okay. Question is, if I really had to be sure, could I notice the counter overflow and just tell everybody to stop while I went and cleaned up? The answer is, well, sure, I could do that, but the point of the design is to avoid doing that because that would be exactly the high variance situation I'm trying to avoid. While I'm doing that, your plane is in free fall because I'm not processing messages going to the ailerons. Right? And it's not that I can dodge the work, right? It's that I want to spread the load so it's a manageable kind of a load. And it turns out that there's a trick, right? So I said we had 2 to the 25 bits, we had 25 bits to play with. Right, and I may have gotten it wrong, but my intention in describing it was we were going to cheat. Oh yes, that's right. So I said we had 2 to the 25 bits. So we had 32 million entries before we got caught. But I was careful to say that the cleanup had to fix things before 16 million entries had gone by. The reason I stole that bit was this had the effect of dividing the number space into two. And if I'm cleaning up twice as fast as I'm getting in trouble, I know I'm not getting caught. That's the intuition. And it's not my intuition. It's a very old garbage collection intuition, actually. Okay. How many people at this point are just totally bewildered? It's okay. I want to throw out one more thing about locking, and then I'm going to get off the locking topic. For large values of one. There are two kinds of locks in the world. It goes on bagels. Locks you absolutely have to have and will wait for. And locks you really want, but you're prepared to back off on acquiring. I'll give an example of a lock you will wait for. An interrupt has come into the machine. Some device wants my attention. Unfortunately, on multiprocessors, strange things happen with interrupts. They get reported to multiple parties. One comes in, I grab it. The same one comes in later because there's another device in the line. Some other CPU gets it, and now we have a race to see who's going to resolve it. One of the very first things I'm going to do when an interrupt comes in is I'm going to mark a bit somewhere that says, I got it, I got it. And I really need to mark this bit, and right now, because if I let go of the processor without marking this bit, what I've just done is I've lost the fact that an interrupt arrived. That interrupt may not come again. I'm guarding against the possibility that it will, but it probably won't. So I need to mark this bit, and right now. This is a place where a general purpose lock is not appropriate. What I need here is something that's commonly called a spin lock. Why? Because I will spin until I get it. And if that takes the rest of eternity, that's how long I will spin. We will hope that it will not. But this is a must-have, so there's a protocol about spin locks from a user standpoint. If I grab a spin lock, I'm under contract to do what I got to do and get out of the way as fast as possible. Further, I am under contract not to grab any lock inside. In most systems, I'm under contract not to grab any lock inside the spin lock or do any other activity that might cause me to sleep or that might cause me to exit the kernel. Because guess what? Then I will have a spin lock held for a long time. And the, you know, in this case, what will happen now is interrupts will stop. And that airplane in free fall is getting close to the ground at this point. This is bad, right? It's not the falling part that gets you. It's the stopping. Okay. Now, in this, Scott's there like, I don't believe he said this.
No, that's not it.
That's not it? Okay.
Oh, I was just thinking of a metric for...
Let's not do metrics for airplane collisions. That's just too depressing. See, I think I see why you went there. But better never to have to measure that, I think. This is kind of like which side of the lawsuit do you want to be on? Neither, right? Okay, so the Kyotis kernel is peculiar in the sense that we can survive exiting from a spin lock. And we can survive it because any condition under which we will exit will invoke the gang release logic, and the format of the spin lock is just like the format of any other lock. So in our system, the difference between a spin lock and a regular lock lies in the algorithm used to acquire it, not in the unrecoverability of failure of the spin lock. Now, having said that, in fact, we don't do yielding operations inside spin locks. That's not quite true. There's one place where we do, but it happens to be a place where we know for reasons of design that we have exclusive dominion over that object, and therefore we will not, in fact, yield. I know because I wrote that code yesterday. We'll break in just a minute. Okay. So there is now a third kind of lock, which went into our code base 2 days ago. Which is, something I meant to say. I said sort of check the syllabus on your way in. What I didn't say is then double check the source code and make sure that what you have is the current version, because things are moving quickly. We found a couple of places where we needed a different kind of locking, and here's the situation. A lock guards you against interference from another processor, but doesn't guard you from interference by hardware. So you could hold the lock and you could get an interrupt. And the question is, what do you do? So there are two different kinds of concurrency you have to worry about. Concurrency between you and your neighbor, and then this very funny kind of concurrency between you and yourself. Let me give you an example of a place where you can get in trouble on self-concurrency. Suppose the interrupt that comes in is the timer interrupt. So this is the timer that says, hey, you're done running. It's time for somebody else to go. Suppose the code that it interrupted is the scheduler. What's about to happen is the interrupt handler is about, maybe, no, I'm sorry, your done running is actually not so bad because we can set a marker and then handle it late. So in that particular case, what the interrupt handler does is it atomically sets a bit in your process state saying, you're the lucky winner, you've been preempted. And then just before we would return to that process, we take note of that. Interesting case is the timer goes off for reason of a sleep having expired, and so the timer wants to take somebody off of a sleep queue and put them onto the ready queue so that they will get running, which ready queue we were in the process of examining when the interrupt went off. And now we're doing wait-free data structures, except that we didn't build wait-free data structures. But to guard yourself against this form of self-concurrency, there's a third class of lock called an IRQ lock. This lock is just like a spin lock, except that it disables interrupts before acquiring the spin lock. The old pattern was disable interrupts, grab the spin lock, do what you got to do, release the spin lock, release the interrupt. That was fine when there was only one such place, which ironically was the printf lock. But you want to be able to call printf from inside an interrupt, don't you? At least if you're debugging. But then we noticed a few other places, and then we ran an emulator, which ran rather slowly, and we discovered that if you set the clock rate too high, emulators can't keep up. 4,000 ticks a second will do it. And what happens then is you don't make it all the way out of the timer interrupt before you have to do the timer interrupt again. Eventually you run out of stack, and that's how you discover the problem. hopefully. That's assuming you put in a guard page. A guard page is a page that's below where the stack is supposed to stop that is not valid. Why? Because you really want to get a page fault when you go off the end of the stack. Why? Because the page fault is what tells you that you went off the end of the stack. In fact, you will never get that page fault. This is a diversion. Why? Because when the page fault happens, the processor will attempt to tell you that a page fault happened, and it will poop that information out onto the stack, which you don't have. At this point, the processor says, oops. It tries to issue, in this case, a second fault called a stack violation, which tries to poop out onto the stack, which you don't have. You're not going to get that one either. At this point, the processor does something called a triple fault. This is like winning the lottery. On most processors, this is called a double fault, but you know, more is better, right? The triple fault, or the double fault, is the one where the mere fact that you got it is what you needed to know. Because there are really only two ways you can generate a triple fault. One is you did it on purpose because you wanted to see the BIOS enforcement, which is how we reboot the machine. The other is you ran off the end of your stack, in which case you have some fairly serious algorithmic problem that you're going to need to look at the hard way. The mere fact that you got the triple or the double fault tells you what you needed to know. And typically, you wire up the triple fault so that it doesn't poop information onto the stack. Or it switches stacks. Or if you go look at how Linux handles this, you will discover that it has a whole separate mechanism for dealing with triple fault so that the hardware will consent to switch to a different stack before telling you you got shot in the head. This is to ensure that the bullet arrives with high reliability. Okay. Having said this about spin locks being recoverable, we do not do yielding operations inside spin locks. So if you see a spin lock taken, and you see something that looks like it might call yield, which is our mechanism for saying abandon ship, it's a bug. And having said that, where we are going to release a lock, and always with a spin lock, because you have to release those. Spin locks, you don't use them unless you've got a high concurrency situation. You'll see that we do observe this stack discipline, but only with respect to the locks that we're planning to release. And we can get into deadlock by not releasing locks, and I'll come to how we recover from that in a moment, and then we'll break. So you'll see a pattern that the spin lock grab actually returns a structure, a spin lock hold info. This is also true for mutex grab, but we usually throw it away. Why? Well, that structure then gets passed to spin lock release. In fact, we know this is being done with the stack discipline. We could hide the pointers, you know, back behind the scenes in the locks themselves. The reason to return that data structure and then pass it as an argument to the release, the compiler now helps us check that we actually obeyed the discipline. You can't release a lock whose spin hold info structure you have misplaced. Conversely, it's very visually obvious what the flow was. And when we're talking about spin locks, the flow is going to happen in a very local way over a very short path of code. We do have places where we get into the if-then-else problem. They're pretty few. Another thing to say is one of the nice things about a microkernel is because interrupts, by and large, are not handled inside the kernel, you have a very small number of cases where you end up using spin locks. The typical case is the kernel gets the interrupt. It does just enough work to tell the interrupt controller, yeah, got the message, working on it, let me call somebody. It does a disable of the interrupt because it doesn't want to get phone calls repeatedly. This is the same thing that customer service does when you're... That requires a temporary spin lock, but once you go off to user land, right, the user land is dealing exclusively with the device. Whereas if the driver was in the kernel, you would see all kinds of concurrency in the drivers that would further complicate this issue. So that's, from a concurrency management perspective, that's an advantage to microkernel design. So I said I was going to get off of this, and I'm almost there. I'm there. This all started because we needed to set up physical memory. Now you might think, hey, we just powered on the machine, man. There's no other CPU running. Why do we need to lock things to figure out where the memory went? The answer is, we don't. But later, when those drivers run, they're going to come back and tell us about physical memory regions we knew nothing about. Our graphics driver is going to go out and say, well, his graphics driver is going to go out and say, hey, there's half a gig of memory over there on that card that you didn't know about. Because the BIOS doesn't tell you about that. I'm going to say, cool, I can't use it, but that's groovy for you. I have to know where it went. And that means that late in the game, after the other processors are turned on, I am going to have potentially concurrent access to the physical memory list, the allocation list. And that means I got to write that code to be defensive about concurrent access. And that means it's got to take these darn locks that early on are completely unnecessary because nobody else is running. Fortunately, the algorithm assumes that a taken lock has a non-zero value, which would mean that it would be bad if we tried to take a lock with the CPU having a lock value of zero. And when we go to undo those locks, we will see the printf saying, yeah, something's broken. You just tried to undo a lock that wasn't grabbed. This is generally a bug, right? So you can see why we'd want to check that. But of course, if we check that, we have to pay the price of taking locks honestly early on, even though they're not actually needed yet. In fact, that code didn't do that until yesterday. Because yesterday, we wrote the first video driver. 2 days ago. Looked at the code and said, okay, good, I'm announcing a region. Oh man, I didn't really do that. So, let me try to summarize this hour and a half, and we'll switch gears in the second half. Concurrency is hard. At least one of you was willing to admit they were confused. Let me tell you, people who've been working on concurrency problems for 20 years are still confused about them. That's why they're problems. The decision to do an atomic kernel design, decision to do an atomic kernel design tremendously simplifies the entire matter of locking discipline because we don't have to worry about backing out in the same way. And I've left out an important piece of that story, which I'm going to do before the break. It's quick. If we were going to do a large monolithic kernel, it's redundant, we would pragmatically be forced into the position of saying, you're going to sleep with resources held. Because the point of a monolithic kernel is you have large investments of work inside the kernel that you would like not to lose. And most of the time, you're not going to get stuck. Right? So you bet on the positive outcome in those designs. So the atomic kernel design is just not practical in a monolithic kernel. There's some experimental work on doing variants that essentially break the long runs into atomic subsequences, but this just makes a mess in the source code. You end up, from the programmer perspective, you end up forced into one of two models. The nice thing about the Unix model is all of my compiler behavior is normal. If I call a procedure, it may sleep down in the middle, but eventually it returns, right? The stack gets honored, and everything behaves in the way that I'm accustomed to as a programmer, right? In an atomic action kernel, what happens is I get down to the bottom, I decide I'm going to bail out, and I reset the stack pointer by hand. I don't even return to those functions. Every function you call that returns a value has three possible outcomes. The value you wanted, some distinguished value saying it didn't work, right? And the third possible outcome is it doesn't return at all, which means you will not get a chance to clean up. And you have to write your code think of that out-of-band return as being very much like an exception that got thrown that crossed several layers of procedure. And what we're saying is there's only one place where you're allowed to put a try block, and that's just at the point of kernel entry. There are a catch block. Think of it as a throw with only one catch block permitted. It qualitatively changes the way you build the code. Well, in a similar sort of way, if we were going to try to take that monolithic system and restructure it as a sequence of micro-operations, what we're forced to do is at the end of each micro-operation, clean up our room so that we're prepared to yield. And that tends to force us into a very different design discipline. So there's a cost to this atomic action approach, right? And what I'm trying to get across here is that this going all the way and saying I'm going to do atomic actions, it does force you to think about procedure calls a little differently, but the end result is at least consistent, and once you get your head around it, you can think that way. That's been our experience. This middle position of saying I'm going to clean up in the middle and come to a sequence point that's clean, and that's where I will allow myself to be preempted, that seems to be hard. It's also slow, because that cleanup, guess what? If you don't stop, you just did a lot of cleanup for nothing. Okay, I did leave something important out, and then we'll break. So gang release is nice in the sense that if I'm bailing all the way and it's fast. Those are good things. If you're going to bail out, right, don't be half-hearted about it. It doesn't resolve the question of, well, if I'm not bailing out and you and I have reached this deadly cyclical embrace, how are we going to get out of it? The answer is one of us is going to have to bail. There are two parts to that. First part is, I'm going to have to detect that I'm stuck. The second part is I'm going to have to bail. Well, the how do I bail I've talked through. What about the how do I detect that I'm stuck? There are basically two things you can do here. In general, detection of a cyclic weight is a known hard problem. It's expensive. It's really expensive. The other option is to say, there are three options. Second option. If I think I might be stuck, figure out, there are always two parties involved in the stuck, right? There's the party who holds the lock and the party who's trying to get it. Figure out which of those parties is operating at higher priority. Loser gets Pittsburgh. There used to be this thing called the Pensic Wars. I mean, if you were part of the Society for Creative Anachronisms, which I never was, but some of my friends were, you'd go and have sword fights, and the joke was that the loser got Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh then became a very nice place, so this joke doesn't really work anymore. So the party at running at lower priority then backs out. This is a little more pessimistic than we would like to be, because we're going to back out a lot because we get unlucky. Now, what's the third alternative, which is the one that Coyotes use? Why is it that the cyclic hold is a problem? The problem is not that I'm in a cyclic hold. The problem is that the cyclic hold will never end. So if I'm stuck, I'm stuck waiting for you. I don't know if we're in a cycle. Suppose that I could somehow learn you get stuck. So if I'm waiting for you and you are still making progress and every path in the kernel is short, then the right strategy is to wait. Because you will make progress, you will get to the end of your operation, or you will give up. Either of those is a form of end of your operation. As long as that will happen quickly, I should wait. Because the critical problem here is not to wait forever. In a little bit is not a problem. If there were a way to know that, you could take a less conservative position. Empirically, that less conservative position is every bit as good as going and looking for the cyclic case. In fact, it's much cheaper because it never happens. I'm going to do that. All right, I'm waiting for you. You are, if you're higher priority, we're done because you're supposed to wait. And I'm supposed to wait. And that's all we need to know. If you're lower priority, now the problem is this is still okay as long as my wait time is short. What's going to make my wait time not short? If you get blocked. What do we do? If you're lower priority, what I do is I reach over into your CPU structure and I set a marker that says, somebody is blocked on you, and they are higher priority than you, and they are waiting for you to release. So if you get to a place where you cannot make progress immediately, for example, if you go to acquire a lock that you cannot immediately obtain, don't wait. Now, this guarantees that there are only two possible outcomes. One, the process holding the lock that I need, or more precisely, the CPU on behalf of that process holding the lock that I need, will get done quickly and let go. And that's fine. Two, CPU holding the lock that I need will get stuck. Notice that it would be really rude to get stuck because it's in my way. Let go. And even if we have a dynamic cycle, okay, so this has the effect of detecting dynamic cycles cheaply. Because the last guy to try to acquire, who's the guy who actually makes the circle, if I'm depending on him, or anybody's depending on him, he's been told that if he can't acquire, he has to let go, with the result that he will back off. So this design actually avoids the deadly embrace. It actually detects the dynamic cycle exactly when the dynamic cycle would violate priority, which is the other interaction in this whole issue that nobody likes to talk about. And the reason this works is because if you are acquiring a lock, you might block. And if you might block, you don't have all your resources yet. And if you don't have all your resources yet, you can't be at the commit point because this is an atomic action kernel. And if you're not at the commit point, you can back out after the commit point and you're stuck in this situation. We get a bigger problem to solve because you violated a design constraint. Okay, so the last thing I want to extract here is what you're seeing here is a situation where there's several design decisions that get made that come together to qualitatively alter how you solve a really, really hard problem of this, in this case, concurrency. And what we needed here was the commitment to short path lengths that you generally only get with a microkernel, the commitment to atomic actions that, you know, I could imagine doing it, but it's very hard to do if it's not a microkernel. Gang release trick, which we can use and augment to get this back off behavior. And the fact that we don't have to worry about short hold times in general, because all hold times are necessarily short because this is a microkernel. And these things coming together give us a place to stand to basically beat this problem into submission and make it go away. Now, anytime somebody stands in front of you and says, we have a known qualitatively hard problem that's been outstanding in the field since the beginning of the field and they've made it go away, the correct response is, what aren't they telling me? Okay. This is, by the way, also the correct response when somebody wants to sell you an adjustable rate mortgage. What they want to tell you is that the sign of the adjustment never works in your favor. Okay. We dropped a requirement. We dropped a requirement because it's misstated. Look at the classic literature, you will find that one of the objectives for any locking system of this sort is fairness. You want the locking system to guarantee that nobody waits forever. This is not a requirement. The requirement you actually want is a much weaker requirement. The weaker requirement is you do not want it to be the case that two parties having the same priority wait forever. If you are always the loser in the priority comparison and you wait forever on a high concurrency object, that's okay. That's what the priority policy told us to do. That did not violate the rules of the locking game. Is if we're at the same priority, we solve this. And I don't know if our current implementation does this because the case never arises in the field. There is a solution for solving this. And the way you do it is essentially, if two guys are otherwise at the same priority, you then use a disambiguating rule. The disambiguating rule amounts to a token. And the token makes its way around the CPUs, right? So I get to win once, and then the next guy gets to win, and the next guy gets to win. And this token is only consulted if we're at the same priority, which never happens in the wild. What you basically do is you induce a rotating resolving mechanism that guarantees fairness. I did cheat, because without that rotating mechanism, the design that I've proposed here does not guarantee fairness. And if you're the loser in the priority race, it does not guarantee progress. And that is as it should be, because that was what you said you wanted when you put the priority system in place. And when I say doesn't guarantee progress, you know what? Low priority processes, if there are really important things to do that are higher priority, low priority processes may never run. And that's as it should be. Okay, let's break, let's come back, and let's look at how we get the machine running. It is now 3:40. That seems to be my magic break time for the first session. Let's come back in 10 minutes, please.